What should I do with my money? That's a question that plagues most people day to day. You don't want to squirrel it all away and have no fun, but you also don't want to wind up in a position where you really need cash on hand, but have none. Welcome to the Just Dumb Enough podcast, a show that acknowledges no one is always an expert by dispelling misconceptions with real experts. I'm your host as always, Colton Petrie. My guest today is Brian Kuderna. Brian is a financial advisor, helping people chase their dreams of early retirements and passive incomes. He explains that true wealth is so much more than the amount of dollars you get in every paycheck, and it really has me looking at each transaction in a very different light. You'll probably learn more in the first 10 minutes of this show than you learned in all of school. Also, side note, as I've mentioned, this is a featured podcast on the Podbean streaming service. Not only a great place to listen to all your favorite shows, but also a great place to start if you'd like to make your very own podcast. Let's figure out what this money can do for us. Welcome to the show, Brian Kuderna.
Yeah, happy to be here, Colton. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you on the show. Why don't you introduce yourself a little bit for the audience?
Yeah, sure thing. So I'm a financial advisor, a CFP or certified financial planner, and I've been doing this for about 16 years now. I started in 2008, right out of college from the College of New Jersey. It was a good time. Obviously, it was the Great Recession, so kind of interesting time to get into the world of finance. And, you know, my clientele span the country nationwide, folks from all different walks of life. I do have a pretty heavy concentration in the medical market. I deal with a lot of doctors and hospitals, but also have folks from a lot of different other careers that we do more retirement and estate planning for. So in a professional sense, that's what I have going on. And then some of my ancillary projects, if you will. I just came out with a book last year called What Should I Do With My Money? So I've been doing a lot with the new book launch through McGraw-Hill. And I have a podcast called The Kuderna Podcast, in which we discuss wealth in a very broad definition as well-being. So we cover personal finance, but also economics, athletics, health, wealth, you know, the whole spectrum. And live in New Jersey, wife, three kids, and a dog named Kona. That's me.
Nice. So, I mean, finance has always seemed like one of those really dense, very difficult subjects. Why pick this? And then how'd you get your start, especially with it being, you know, a recession in 2008?
Yeah. So I'll try and summarize. When I went into college, I didn't really know what I wanted to be. I know in high school, I took a marketing class and an entrepreneurship class, both which I really liked. And I always did well in school, but I wasn't like a huge fan of math and science and a lot of the technical, just kind of formal subjects. So went to college down at the University of Tampa, wasn't sure really what I was going to be. I was a marketing major. And then when I had so many business courses and really good professors down there, I was like, wow, I love this. Like, I'm so happy I picked this, like this whole business world, which we have almost no exposure to growing up. I was like, there's so much here. And my dad, I mean, he works for the Army. My mom was a paralegal. So everything in the corporate, entrepreneurial, you know, that world was really kind of foreign to us. So that's kind of how it started in Tampa. Then when I transferred to TCNJ, I was still marketing, but I actually had an interview with the DEA. And they said, you know, if you want to work for us, we're all about following the money. That's how we find the bad guys. They said, if you switch to finance or accounting, we'll talk. And I was like, all right, I definitely don't want to do accounting. That I found to be very boring. But I liked, you know, finance. I liked how businesses operate, how they become profitable. I liked investing, you know, how to make money become more money. So I switched to finance. And lo and behold, shortly thereafter, I had an offer for an internship in a wealth management firm. And I was like, all right, it's there. Let's take it. It was kind of funny at the time. I was working all over in the summers. I was a bouncer at a nightclub by us. I was working during the day as a lifeguard and also at a deli. So I'm doing these weird things. And then I pick up this gig as a financial advisor, as an intern. And that was pretty much it. You know, they said, we'll give you the tools, we'll teach you, you're going to build your own business. It's very hard. And I was like, I like the idea of the challenge and getting to pave my own way. And so I said, let's run with it, and never looked back. Now here I am.
I like that. A deli, a bouncer, a lifeguard, and one step away from the DEA.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's funny. There's a thing we have to fill out every couple of years called a U4 form. And it's so that we can hold our securities licenses to do, you know, investments and things like that. And on that, you put your employment history. So when I did my first U4, I remember my manager was like, "What the heck? Like, you're coming into the finance world? Like, this is quite an odd career history." And yeah, that was it.
Yeah. You're like, well, everybody gets a start somewhere.
That's right. That's right.
So speaking of everybody, getting their start, like you said, your book is called What Do I Do With My Money? What is kind of the first advice you give to people that are looking for, the entry level finance advice?
Yeah, great question. So when you really kind of bring it down to basics, the first thing I would say is save it. You know, that if you just get no other advice than that, number one, you got to work to make money. Okay. A lot of, and that might sound like duh, but you'd be shocked how many people out there think, no, there's got to be some other shortcuts, or what if, you know, I buy into this or I invest into that. There are no shortcuts in finance. That's something I can almost guarantee. The way to make money is to go out and work for it. Once you do that and you have an income and you have a little bit of a surplus, you want to save it. Okay, that's next. People ask, you know, how do I get really wealthy? How do I get rich? And I'm like, well, you got to make a lot of money and then you got to save a lot of money. All right, and that's kind of two steps there. They don't just go together. You don't make a lot of money and become rich. I know people that make a fortune. And every year, it's like they hit the reset button because their lifestyle is so extravagant. And on the flip side, I know people that don't make a ton of money, but over time have become very wealthy because what they do earn, they keep and they put away. And that is just the basics. That's the blocking and tackling of finance. After that, we can get much more creative as being a financial advisor to enhance the plan. But that's step one, man, is go make money. And then save that money.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe that's the most important thing, but it's not necessarily the easiest part because you're like, look, man, it's hard. You got to work hard. You got to save money.
Yeah.
Neither one's fun.
Yeah, I always say simple, but not easy.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, how do you span that gap between like, I know in your book you've said there's a difference between being rich and being wealthy. How do you kind of make that jump?
Yeah, and so that's what I like to tell clients and people I initially meet through seminars and stuff is, you know, there's rich people that work really hard and make a lot of money, and then there's wealthy people who work really hard and then their money makes a lot of money. And the goal, what I try and coach people on, is we want to get into that wealthy side. And I'm not out to define what wealthy means for anybody. Some people could say, hey, I can pay my rent every month and I get to go to the discount movies every Friday, you know, afternoon. And, you know, my wife and I go on a picnic and we feel comfortable. That could be the ultimate in wealth for one person, where another could have millions and millions of dollars and feel like they're just completely inadequate. So that definition of wealth varies from person to person. But I think that's kind of the key, is to differentiate rich and wealthy in that sense. And what I mean by that is just purely income inflows and being blind to your outflows versus seeing both sides of the coin and making sure that we're being a little bit smarter with it. And so I think that's really, you know, what you have to do from just a 10,000 foot view.
I thought you had a great example where you say, like, all right, little Timmy or Johnny, whoever mows 3 yards and they pay for a month of Xbox Live. It might seem like a poor financial decision, but if they get 100 hours of enjoyment out of that because that's what they want to do, like that amount of enjoyment could make him very wealthy, just by like
Yep.
he's enjoying his life.
Exactly. And that's, I use that little story in the intro to start explaining to people what exactly economics is. And what I love about the study of economics is diving a little bit deeper than, you know, where we delineate between price and cost. You know, and that's where price is something that is fixed. We know what it is. It's a printed item that we can all agree. Okay, if you tell me you're going to sell me a pizza pie for $20, We all know that that costs $20. We know what that is. But then the cost is what each person gets to define. And like you said, you know, for the kid that says, oh, I mowed these yards and I bought my Xbox Live subscription, to him, that might be the greatest thing in the world. For someone else, that carries no value. And that's where when we start to have these conversations and negotiations, whether it's on the micro level of, you know, where are we going to have dinner tonight, or the macro level of how, you know, governments are, you know, coordinating their plans moving forward, it all boils down to what they deem is valuable and trying to remember to focus on cost and not just on price. Because if you focus on price, you're going to lose every time, because that's just one, you know, spoke of the wheel.
Yeah, it's a very interesting way to look at it. Even, you know, for the normal person to look at your memories, like thinking about a pizza. I've ate a lot of pizzas that definitely have a direct price to cost, where it's like, yeah, $20, whatever. But I've also had some where it's like you share them with friends at a bachelor party or doing whatever, and you're like, those pizzas were worth their cost because, like, I got so many memories out of them.
Exactly. Exactly. And so that's, you know, when you start to kind of look at everything, I always say, you know, money, whether you like it or not, it's kind of the lifeblood of all these different kind of domains that we start to talk about. So you just got to recognize it. And I think once you can, you know, say, okay, there's a difference between value and just the price that's paid for something. And if you can understand that, kind of know thyself and understand what it means to you, but then also if you're in negotiations, whether it's in the business world or elsewhere, trying to put yourself in the other person's shoes, I think gives you a great vantage point where then now it's kind of like you're in the matrix where you get to see it all. And I think that's ultimately how you make smarter decisions rather than just a quick knee-jerk reaction of, all right, that price looks good. Boom, I'm in. Well, is that something that in a week or a month or in a year, you're going to be glad you did that?
You're like, how much thought was behind this purchase or this investment? Because it's not necessarily sound just because it sounded good. So in talking, you know, before bringing you on the show, there was one thing in your history that I was like, oh, I'd love to hear about this. And I feel like I know nothing about it. And that is angel investing. Can you kind of tell people what that is?
Yeah. So angel investing, it kind of has like a cool name to it. I guess it's not that cool. Is if you've ever heard of venture capital. So and just to give your listeners kind of some background. So when companies want to go out and raise funds, all right, if I say, hey, I got a great business idea. I came up with this widget that I think is going to blow people away and everybody's going to want one. And you say, all right, well, how do I get started? How am I going to manufacture it? How am I going to market? How am I going to bring it to market? You know, all the different things that all cost money, right? So you can go to the bank and you can try and get a loan. You can go ask, you know, your buddies or your family, hey, pitch in a few dollars and maybe we'll kind of share in the progress here. Or if you say, I really want to look at other avenues, investors that I want to take on, all right? The three kind of channels you have, if you will, the biggest one is going public, all right? That's when I have a nice, well-developed company and I want to actually trade on the public markets. I want to go to the New York Stock Exchange where people all over the world can invest and buy shares of my company. That's like the granddaddy of them all, is going public. Then you have venture capital or private equity sometimes kind of would be maybe before that, where you're going to take on select investors, but you're not that big. It's maybe a little more speculative. And then angel investing is almost like the prerequisite to that one. All right. Angel investing could be just going out and getting small investors on the internet that say, hey, yeah, I'll chip in $1,000 in this kind of novel idea that you have and become an initial shareholder in your company. Things like that, that's often what's referred to as angel investing when it's on like a much more or smaller scale typically.
Yeah, it seems like the private business version of crowdfunding.
Very similar. Yeah. I mean, some people will refer to crowdfunding as like angel investing.
Interesting. I mean, is there like a specific benefit or, you know, reason just to do like, do you seek angel investing or is there like a place people go to generally find it?
No, it's it could be through things like you mentioned, different sites for crowdfunding. There's lots of different groups or associations out there that you can go and kind of pitch your idea almost as if you're like on Shark Tank to these angel investors that might want to buy in. A lot of them, you know, what I've seen is it's like these niche spaces where everybody knows each other. All right. So it's not just, you know, big tech. It might be a part of technology, right? It might be the people that design the lights that go in the back of my keyboard so that they light up different colors and want to come up with a new idea that creates a softer light, right? Something, I'm just throwing that out there. I have no idea what any of that is, but that's an industry. And it's probably a pretty small industry where people know each other that design, you know, that hardware. And so if they come up with a new idea, they might have on speed dial 10 people that they know they could reach out to that know the space, that have deep pockets, and would say, yeah, you know, I'll throw some money in there and see how that plays out. That's the sort of thing usually where angel investing gets started.
Is this kind of like the two sides of peak capitalism where you're like, you could angel invest your money and like, you know, in a very small community in a very sideways way, like you're making that money hopefully work for you later, versus like very public investing where you're doing, you know, stocks and bonds and things? Like those are the two sides of the same coin?
Kinda, yeah. I mean, if you think about it, they're serving the same purpose, in that somebody that is the business owner or the entrepreneur has an idea, but they're like, I just can't finance this whole thing by myself. I need help here. Going public, being a publicly traded stock like Nike or Apple, you know, they can have thousands of shareholders around the world that are putting money up there to own a piece of that company, where what we were just describing is the same methodology, but it's on a much, much smaller scale. So usually a lot more speculative, a lot more risky. But then those people, because it's kind of like a small contingent, they might have more control over the future of that company. They may not have to deal with a huge board of directors and, you know, proxy votes and everything else dictating what they can and cannot do. Sometimes that's the beauty of not being public, is that you retain more control over your company.
Yeah, it sounds like that's kind of the big benefit, you know, is that like I have some say in this business that I believe is going to go somewhere, versus like I think the typical crowdfunding, a lot of us, at least me, are familiar with is like Kickstarter, where you're like, oh, I'm investing in a very early version of this product so that I get it cheaper because I believe it's going somewhere, and it may or may not.
Yeah. And, you know, companies sometimes can go back and forth. Some companies, they'll say, all right, I want to go public because I want to get a lot of cash and I want to expand this company. Sometimes you have executives or founders at the top that are ready to cash out. So they'll go public and then boom, their shares, their ownership is now equated to like so much value that's readily available to them. So that's one of the benefits of going public. And then sometimes they'll be public and then they'll actually want to go back to being private, where they'll buy out all their shareholders, take ownership back of the company, go off of the exchange. So now they're like, all right, we did the public thing. We were losing control of the company. We want to kind of corral it back in, maybe make it smaller again and go back to like their core mission. And so sometimes you see companies do that, where then they'll go back to being a little more focused and usually go private.
Interesting.
One of the benefits, I would say, real quick to that point, like versus, I think you said Kickstarter and some of the others, what is, I think, appreciated for public companies when you invest in them is that there's a set of standards as far as their accounting that investors or potential investors can review. So usually there's a longstanding history. There's a lot of documentation that you could read and see, okay, these are the, you know, primary owners, these are the executives, this is their board of directors, their management team, here's what their books look like over the past 3 years, they've been losing money or they've been profitable. So you can really research a lot of that before you make your investment decision. When you go into the private kind of smaller space, that's one of the biggest risks you face, is you don't always have such a concrete kind of layout of what that company's balance sheet may look like. And so you have to do maybe a little bit more due diligence to make sure it's okay.
See, don't just hear, listen, trust me, we're making money. And you're like, no, I'd like to see it though.
Yeah, it's not that easy.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I never thought, I guess, about like major companies have the ability to go back to being private. Like if they can just buy their outstanding stocks, they just take themselves off the market.
Yeah, it's happened many times.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, because it does seem like a lot of, I think that's the notorious thing, right? Infamy of Kickstarter is that, like, oh, it may or may not pay out. And so you're like, yeah, I mean, we're working in a little less regulated and a little less, concrete stuff. Like it seems like it could be riskier.
100%. Yeah, and that's where, you hear so many stories of, like, I put some money up, this guy had this idea. Who knows if the idea was even real? Sometimes they're so new and they're so kind of small at that stage. It's almost like a roll of the dice. And I think a lot of people understand that, but you got to know. And I don't do any of this stuff on Kickstarter or whatnot, but from my understanding, a lot of these smaller kind of ground floor operations, you put money up there. Yeah, is there the chance it becomes that monster success and you quadruple and become? Yeah, that's possible. But I think there's also a lot of possibility you put the money up there and in 2 months that company doesn't even exist. And that's where you can, have money at risk.
So how long into your financial tenureship that you've been in did you run into angel investing? Like, when did that become a thing in your life?
So it's not something that I do. It's kind of like a niche thing. I'm familiar with it, but I certainly wouldn't say I'm an expert. It's not something I do personally either. Me personally, I invest, in the markets, in the public markets through my retirement plans, through my brokerage accounts and things like that, and stocks and ETFs. I do real estate. I have another number of rental properties. So I like that model. I'm pretty familiar with it. I have whole life plans that I put money into, but as far as angel investing, it's nothing I've done yet.
Gotcha. Yeah, it was one of those I was wondering where it's like, when you heard about it, what'd you think? Did it seem like strange or absurd to even consider?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, I've been proposed about a number of ideas. But to me, I mean, there's got to be something there that would really pique my interest, either an exorbitant potential financial gain, or it's something that I just really believe in, something I like or that I'm passionate about, then maybe I'd entertain it, but it's not something I would actually make a part of my financial plan.
So if somebody had, a decent chunk of money, they've been saving for a while, they've got six figures just stored away somewhere. What's kind of your like, ooh, do this thing first? Is it, traditional investing, or is it like getting into real estate? Is there one that you're like, this is the first one? It's really good.
Yeah, so there's no one size fits all, and I do have to preface, especially for like compliance disclosures. This isn't advice or anything that I'm sharing out there, just general information, but everybody should kind of consult their own professionals on this, their own advisors. What I would say in that type of scenario, I'll start with I have a four-step planning process that, and I don't know if you saw this in the book, but number one is protection first. All right, so that's talking to clients about like their insurances, their life insurance, their disability insurance, their health insurance, their liability insurance, different things like that, where if stuff hit the fan and life goes sideways, we know that they're going to be protected. All right, that's number one and one of the most often overlooked. Number two is building liquidity. Okay, so again, just a general rule of thumb that I tell people is that you should have 6 months of your expenses in cash. And what cash is something readily available, checking, savings, money market account. You can get at it today just by going on your phone or to the ATM. All right. So if you do your budget, that's the first thing I would tell that person is like, do a budget, see how much it is that you guys are spending on a monthly basis. With your rent, your utilities, your credit card bills, et cetera. If you say, hey, I'm spending like $5,000 a month just living, all right, then six times that's 30K. That's what I would like to see as a goal is try and have that buffer there just sitting in the bank. And we know that come hell or high water, we can go access that. So that's your 6 months expenses. Now, if you've done that, the next thing we'll look at is debt, particularly high interest debt. So if you got credit card debt, you have personal loans, things of that nature, auto loans, stuff that has higher than normal interest rates, we want to target that because that's going to be like a headwind against any of your progress. All right. So that person might come to me and say, hey, Bri, I just got 100 grand. because you know, Aunt Susie in Arkansas just passed away and I just fell out of thin air into my lap. What do I do? We're going to look at protection. We're going to look at liquidity and we're going to look at their debt. If all three of those are in good order, no bad debt, they've got 6 months at least in the bank, their insurances are where they should be. Then if there's still that money left over, then we'll go to the fourth step of wealth accumulation or investing. And that's when the first thing we really need to do once we've kind of reached that phase is understand, number one, what's their risk tolerance? Are they aggressive? Are they conservative? Really understand that about themselves. And then the next thing is, how quickly will we need to use the money? And if they say, I don't need this money for 10 years or forever, it's just newfound money, that can give us a lot of options as far as how we're going to invest that. If they're like, yeah, you know, I'm probably going to need it like in 2 years, I'm trying to buy this condo and saving up for a down payment. All right, then we're not really going to be investing much. Because I always say, if we're investing for less than 3 years, we're not really investing, we're just gambling. We're just hoping that we go in at the right time and then bang, when we need that money, that the market happens to be higher. Otherwise, that's where we can kind of lose control of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting way to look at it, to say like, you're not investing, you're gambling, because on that short term, mm-hmm. like there are zero guarantees. Like yeah. Any 3 year period is the craziest 3 year period you've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. In that scenario you described, you come into $100,000 and it's 2006. And you say, all right, I meet those criteria, 1, 2, and 3 are in good order. Let's go invest, Bri. And we take that 100 grand and we build the best investment plan we can for that client. And then in 2008, they're like, oh, hey, dude, I need all that money back. You know, I got to fix my car or we're moving or whatever. Well, guess what? I mean, almost everything across the board got clobbered in 2008. So that 100 grand in just a generic stock portfolio could easily have turned into 60 grand or 50 grand. And now they need that money back. That was the worst thing they ever did, right? But now if we built that portfolio in 06 and stayed the course, and here we are in 2024, that's going to be way, way more money, right? So it was the same investment, that same bucket of ingredients, but it was the timing that was important. And if they didn't need the money and had that long-term vision, they'd be sitting here at 2024, you know, happy as could be. But if they had that short 1, 2 year outlook and had the cash out in 08, then they got obliterated and they didn't have that chance to rebound. And so that's one thing I'm constantly telling people is, you got to understand your time horizon. And don't lie to yourself. You've got to be honest and true to that, because if you're not, now you're starting to roll the dice again.
Well, and I think that goes back to what you started with, right? Is you're like, this is working really hard, saving, investing, like really long-term strategies, because mm-hmm. if you continue to, you know, stay the course and work hard, like just let that money do its thing versus like trying to get rich quick, because you're like, there is no easy out for this. You're not going to throw money out here and then just hit the lottery.
Yep. And that right there, I'm telling you, Colin, that's probably the hardest thing about my profession, is I can sit down with a client and say, hey, you and your spouse, you're doing well. You got good careers. Here's, you know, the plan that we're going to draw up. And with a very high degree of certainty, you're going to check all your boxes and hit all your goals. We're just going to stick to it. And we're going to do this for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And then you're going to get to where you want to be. When you show somebody that, they might say, I agree with you wholeheartedly, but then doing it is another story. Because then they take this plan that you drew up, they go home, they listen to a podcast, they watch the news, they listen to, you know, some blog that they just read. And before you know it, they're like, well, what if we did this? What if we put our money here? What if we invest in this thing and it were to double in a couple of years? And they have all these different voices kind of like going after that plan. And that's one of the hardest things, is to tell people, do you want to get wealthy, you know, with a high degree of certainty, but the price, really the price, is you've got to be patient. Or do you want to go over to all these kind of new sexy ideas and roll the dice and see what happens? You know, you start to go down that road, and usually, at least anecdotally, I see it doesn't end very well. So that's one of the hardest things, is just saying, all right, it's kind of boring. I just got to stay the course here.
Well, and I can see that, like, having some very loose sources and letting that make some decisions for you where you're like, I really want to invest in real estate, but it's 2017 and everyone thinks real estate's going to fall out because it's higher than it's ever been. And you're like, just trust me, you've got to invest in it and stay in it. And they're like, nah, it's going to fall out soon. And then here we are, 24, and you're like, yeah, real estate's doubled. I don't know what to tell you.
And that's the thing. I'm like, the past, they always say, like in our disclosures, past performance cannot predict future performance or is not indicative of future performance. It's true, but all we have as far as information to go off of is history. And if you just pull up, if anyone that's listening goes and Googles, stock market history or S&P 500, look at the maximum time frame. And they look at what the stock market has done over the past 80 years. You go do the same thing for real estate, real estate values, median value of American home. Look at that long-term history. Yeah, they go up and down. There's blips along the way, but you can see a pretty long-standing upward trend. And so when you see something like that, I think the natural instinct should be, okay, I'm going to stay the course. I want to participate in this thing, this asset that appreciates over time. But then it's that human error that comes into play where our emotions get involved and we hop in, we hop out, we want to try other things, then we go back. And that's where the financial plan starts to just become like this junk drawer of ideas.
What I once heard, I don't even know what his qualifications were. I was definitely listening to a podcast, and so it was like, ah, good information. But it was one of those that stuck with me where they said, like, if you're just holding all of your money in a savings account or in a checking account or wherever, you're losing money every year. Because not only have you not invested it to gain money, inflation is happening and your money is not keeping up with that. So you're actually losing a percent of your money every year just because it's not going anywhere.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, you look at, 2022 when inflation went speeding away to, 8%, numbers that we hadn't seen in like 40 years. Meanwhile, if your money's just sitting in a checking or savings account getting 0.1% at that time, you look at that spread there, that's where people are like, oh, I can't keep up. I can't afford my groceries. That's it right there, is you've got to be able to keep pace with inflation and ideally outperform inflation. And that's where at some point you can get financially independent.
So is there kind of a, like, when you're looking at the liquidity of things, obviously to me, like, real estate always sounds like a cool investment because I'm like, oh, owning something super tangible and not just like, well, I have a share of this company, which I guess they're equally as like valid, but I'm like, yeah, I own this land. That seems like the least liquid asset possible.
And yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. So the real estate is certainly more tangible. You go buy a stock in Disney. Back in the day, at least in the mail, you'd get like a certificate that actually had a little Mickey Mouse on it. But that's all you had to say. Oh, I put in 10 grand into Disney World. And now all of a sudden, I got this little certificate that could be redeemed at some point in the future. You go buy a house. Yeah, we got land, we got rooms, we got walls that we could touch and feel. But when you look at the liquidity, that's the difference between, a publicly traded stock and real estate. If I own those shares in Disney, I can go right on my computer with two clicks of a button. In 5 minutes, I can have all that money back, just like that. You cannot do that with your home. All right. You got to go list that home, work with your realtor, find a good buyer, go through all this stuff, go through them getting their mortgage and the closing and 1,000 other things. And after all the fees and whatever the market value in your particular locale is, you hope at that time that it all worked out. But yeah, it's I won't say it's the least liquid asset, but it's definitely not one that you want to view as near-term, money.
And I have a follow-up to this, but what is the
Sure.
least liquid, just to, as a curiosity?
Yeah, so I don't know if there is a least liquid, but the ones that are less liquid are going to be anything where you're locking that money up for a period of time. So what I mean by that, I mean, let's just take a look at, qualified retirement plans. So that could be like your 401k at work. That could be you opening up an IRA account, an individual retirement account, right? Where you say, I'm going to put some money away for retirement. Now, if I'm 55 years old, and I'm putting money in there, maybe that doesn't seem so illiquid, right? When I turn 59 and a half, I can go ahead and access that money without penalty. It's my money, all right? So that's only 4 years away, 5 years away in that scenario. If I'm a 23-year-old kid starting in my career, making some money, and I just have an auto, payroll deduction going in this 401k, all right, now I'm putting money in for retirement, but in theory, by and large, I can't touch that for another, almost 40 years without having to pay taxes and penalties and so forth. So I think that's kind of the thing, is it's not the particular assets. Sometimes it's the accounts or the vehicles that we put our money into that have strings attached or penalties or surrender charges or what have you, where now it's not so liquid. It could be years, it could be decades before we can just be free and clear with that money.
Gotcha. Yeah, it kind of made me think, like, right as soon as you started talking, like, oh, locking in your money. I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess that's what bonds always were, right? Like, you hold this for 5 years, you get X return. But it's like, there is, if your house takes a year to turn around and sell, it's still five times faster than holding a 5-year bond.
Exactly. Yeah. You get a 10-year treasury or whatever the case may be. Those are designed to be held, to duration, typically to that point in time before it matures. So yeah, that's where I always tell people all different assets have different values to them. And the rate of return, and I'll kind of share another general rule of thumb. I always tell people, look at any investment as a stool with three legs, right? One leg is going to be the market risk. Is it going to be jumping up and down all over the map, or is it more the slow and steady? The other leg is going to be liquidity. Is it money that if tomorrow I change my mind and need it, I can have it? Or is it money that really I can't touch for another 15 years? All right. And then the third one is going to be the tax consequence. All right. Is it money that I got a tax break on today, but then way down the road, I've got to pay the piper? Or is it money that I'm going to pay taxes every year on that? So they all have different values there. And that's where sometimes people just look at something and say, well, what has a better rate of return? All right. Just like we were talking price and cost at the very beginning of the conversation, when you look at an investment, there's other values that you got to recognize: the taxation, the liquidity, and then the risk, and then make a decision that's respective of all three.
Yeah, I wanted to jump back real quick because I had thought about this thing in thinking about real estate being this very like tangible investment. There are some companies out there, and I don't know if these are like giant red flags or not, but they're like, oh, you put in, however much money you're comfortable putting in, and it's basically a pool of a company, and we're buying, land and resource, and we're like doing improvements. And so you'll see returns like dividends, but you don't necessarily like own the land because you own a piece of what the company owns. Is that like some weird point between like real estate and stock investing?
Yeah, no, so it's something interesting you brought up. I believe what you're describing are called REITs, or real estate investment trusts. And so what that is if some of your listeners are familiar with like mutual funds, all right, that might be probably the most popular example, where in the investing sense, you might say, hey, I have $2,000 that I want to try and set aside and invest. All right. If I want to go buy Amazon, Facebook and Nike and a couple other big companies, well, with my $2,000, I may have just bought like two shares of each. So I'm not very diversified. My money didn't really go that far. So you say, all right, what I'll do instead is I'll take my $2,000. I'll put it in this mutual fund with Fidelity or Prudential or whoever it may be, or Vanguard. And then that money is now pooled with thousands of other investors, so that this fund, this bucket of money that now has my $2,000 investment, but all these other guys put money in, it's maybe worth $1 billion. And so then you have these fund managers at the top that say, okay, we've got $1 billion in this fund. Now we can go out, and with economies of scale, we can go buy a whole bunch of different companies. And so the idea is, it's like you got a small slice of a huge pie. So you got a lot of diversification, you got some management expertise. So you were able to do a lot with just that $2,000 that you couldn't do on your own. What you kind of described, the real estate investment trust, is like the same concept, But then instead of saying, all right, we're going to invest in big tech companies or in blue chip stocks, they're going to invest in real estate. And a lot of them will have like a particular directive where they'll say, okay, we're going to invest in commercial office space in New York City. And that's what that REIT invests in. Or they invest in cell phone towers and they go out and they buy all the land that owns the cell phone towers. You know, so that's where you can go in all different directions. There's good ones, bad ones, all based on that individual and what they're trying to do. But yeah, it's just a product that's out there.
Are there any of those that you see where you're like, they're like, oh, hey, try this new investing thing that most people aren't familiar with, where you're like, red flags everywhere. Do your super hard research before you look at these.
100%. I mean, as an advisor, I would say I'm solicited probably, I'm not even exaggerating, like 100 times a week with new ideas, whether it's people trying to get me to invest my own money or people trying to get me to invest my clients' money in all these different opportunities out there. So honestly, for me, just because I'm so inundated with these different investment proposals, is it has to be something crazy that just cuts through the clutter, all right? Because what my job is to really take all that noise out there and then simplify it to find what's the best and the most efficient opportunities for my clients that are tried and true, all right? That I know I understand them personally. And so that then I can, you know, act with confidence when I manage my clients' money. And what, unfortunately, the layperson or a lot of the people that aren't in the business that maybe say, hey, I want to try and manage my own portfolio, they may not get inundated with 100 different ideas every week, but they might get 5 a week in their email and they might say, oh, this sounds really cool. And they're promising all these different great returns and everything else. And they don't know what to look for. They don't understand the ins and outs of that. And that's unfortunately lots of times where you see people think that they did something right. And then they find out down the road, like, oh, crap, what did I do with my money? And there's something I always tell people when I do these shows or seminars, I always tell them that I didn't know is not an excuse. Okay, that's just the reality of finance. And I've heard it 1,000 times where they thought they invested in something, they thought their contracts of this or that, and then 2 years, 3 years, 10 years down the line, it didn't perform the way they wanted. And they're like, man, this isn't fair. Like, I thought it did this. I didn't know. And it's like, well, good luck just trying to say I didn't know. That's not really, a strong stance to have.
Yeah. You're like, this doesn't recoup any of your money. It's just, I guess, makes you feel better.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really a lot of my job too, is being able for my clients to take all that away. That, well, I don't know, there's so much out there, there's so much noise, there's so many different thoughts, I'm just going to kind of go with what sounds best. That's the whole point of coming to a financial advisor, is that this is what we eat, live, and breathe, and we see it all. And so we don't kind of get tricked. Okay, we're doing the homework so that when we say to a client, hey, here's what's available, here's what we want to do, this is the way it works, and we're telling you that, as opposed to you hoping that you're interpreting something the right way.
Yeah, fantastic advice. And thank you for all this, Brian. This has been amazing. Thank you for so much information. I wanted to make sure people can find more of you if they're looking to find more of you. Where are you at?
Yep. Yeah. So I think I'm kind of all over the place, but I guess a good starting point is just go to briancaderna.com. So that's BryanKuderna.com. I got a lot of good information there. You can sign up for a weekly newsletter I have called Weekly Wealthy Wisdom, where I just share in a 3-minute read, kind of my greatest insights of the week. So you can always check that out. My show, the Kaderna Podcast, we really dive into a lot of this. So we have a whole catalog of episodes from personal finance, economics, and on. And then if you really want it all in the best way you can, please go check out my book, What Should I Do With My Money? That's where I've just laid it all out as clear as day. So available wherever books are sold.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, I will put the link to that, your website, in the description. Please do check out the show. I love promoting other podcasts. This is a great way to do it. Make sure you subscribe, leave good reviews. Same thing for the book. If you're picking up these books, leaving a good review is so important to like everyone who is in this creative space. So huge thing to do. Brian, again, thank you so much. I have appreciated your time immensely.
Yeah, thank you, Colton. This was fun. I hope it was helpful. And I just want to echo that sentiment too, that I never thought of leaving a review for a book. And then when you become an author and you're like, wow, that word of mouth is so critical. So yeah, again, the book is What Should I Do With My Money? If you do check it out, guys, please leave a review on Amazon or Barnes and Noble because it does help more than I could say.
Yes, absolutely. Leave a review.
Thank you.
Seriously, go leave good reviews for the things you enjoy. In other news, the March rankings are competitive, to say the least. Number one, the United States, led by New York, California, and Washington. Number two, Canada, with Ontario still leading. Number three, England of the United Kingdom. Number four, Australia, with Queensland taking over as top territory. And number five, Ireland, holding on to that spot very tightly. That's it for this week. Have a great week, a great weekend, and I'll see you all back here next week for another new episode. Until the next episode, pretty please do all those things that help the show grow, like rating, reviewing, liking, and subscribing. Reach out to dumbenoughpodcast@gmail.com or on any of the other social medias if you want to reach me personally. But most importantly, stay dumb.